You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Speech and Drama, Collected Works, Volume 282, translated by Mary Adams. This is Lecture 4, entitled How to Attain Style in Speech and Drama, given on the 8th of September, 1924. My dear friends, it is our concern in these lectures to find the way to the artistic forming of speech and also of dramatic action, taking our start always from the speech organism itself. To this end, it is of vital importance that we should not be content with theoretical expositions, but accompany these throughout with practical demonstration. Thus, you had opportunity yesterday to see how the iambic and the trochaic meter has each its particular part to play in the development of the art of speech. And now, today, we will begin by showing how it is possible, in domains of speech where the path of development is sought, not in an entirely inward but in a rather more external way, how it is possible, even there, to go over from prose into poetic form, into the artistic, into style. We have seen that the significance of the iambic meter lies in the fact that it helps to promote in the whole organism of speech this transition to poetic form and style, even sometimes to the genuinely lyrical. The trochaic and dactylic meters, on the other hand, whilst they too have the tendency to work in this direction, taking us away from prose, can also help the student who practices them to speak prose itself artistically. I am here merely recalling what we considered together yesterday. Today we propose to demonstrate for you the rendering in speech of a kind of verse where there is the wish to maintain poetic form throughout, but where the poet comes up against a certain difficulty. He wants, for example, to sustain a particular description or narration for a longer period, perhaps throughout many lines of verse. But, owing to the nature of the language, he is unable to keep it going entirely in the iambic meter or entirely in the trochaic. Hence we find a tendency to compromise between prose and poetic form. And it is this compromise that we have in the Alexandrine, which has properly six iambics, but which, since it is not very easy to maintain such a meter for any considerable time, constantly interposes passages where the iambic is not strictly adhered to. Thus a kind of compromise is effected. But wherever the language becomes rhetorical, parenthesis, rhetorical language has, you know, a slight flavor of decadence about it, close parenthesis, a tendency immediately becomes evident to form the verse iambically throughout, keeping it strictly within the limits of the original rhythm. All this we may find in the Alexandrine. Consequently, when used as an exercise for speech, the Alexandrine can work in the opposite way to the hexameter. Speaking in hexameters leads, as we have seen, to good prose speaking. The Alexandrine, on the other hand, is an excellent preparation for speaking poetry. This we will now illustrate for you in the rendering Frau Dr. Steiner will give of some of French Alexandrines. Alexandrines are at their best in French. When they are used in the German language, they always seem rather like an imitation. They seem out of place there. Alexandrines are not, in fact, a natural product of the German language. It will accordingly be best to take a French example for demonstration. There are a number of passages entitled Faust where Goethe deviated from other meters into the Alexandrine, and in each single instance the occasion for it can be clearly discerned. Goethe has recourse, namely, to the Alexandrine when he begins to find difficulty in being poetical in any other way. Where he has a scene in which it is difficult to be inwardly poetical, he resorts to being poetical outwardly. And so we find in Faust, wherever this dilemma occurs, the transition to the Alexandrine. Now Frau Dr. Steiner speaks. The example I am giving is taken from a dramatic poem by Le Comte de Lille, Hypatia, in other words, I suppose we could say. Readers aside there. The cultured young adherent of the ancient wisdom, who will shortly be torn in pieces by the infuriated mob in the streets of Alexandria, is admonished by Bishop Cyril to be converted and so escape violent death. She, on her part, points to the everlasting disputes that go on within the church, a church that has become not only terribly dogmatic, but brutally savage, and affirms her unswerving adherence to the ancient esoteric wisdom. Readers aside, now there is the Hypatie, or however it would be said in French. It's all in French, quite long, a couple pages. And then the English, I will not read that translation. And then after that, there is Faust, Part 2, Act 3, Scene 1, in English. I will not read that. And now we're back to Dr. Steiner. And now we must go on to consider how we may find in speech ways that lead over from one realm of poetic creation to another. For they are there to be found in the very use and forming of speech. Narrative comes to expression just as well in the trochaic meter as in the dactylic. Let us take an example of narrative in trochees and see what it can reveal. To present narrative in trochaic meter accords quite simply with man's original instinctive feeling. And you will discover, moreover, that the tone of voice required for narrative can most easily be found when speaking in trochees. On this account, the trochaic meter is a good preparation also for the art of speaking prose, an art which has to penetrate more instinctively into the instruments of speech and into the heart. Now in narrative, in epic poetry, as I said in the first lecture, the reciter has the object standing there before him in thought. His thought of it may, however, become so vivid that he surrenders himself to be an instrument for what the object speaks and does. When this happens, narrative goes over into drama. We have thus found here a way to pass from narrative that contains a dramatic element to the art of drama itself. Not every narrative, not every epic does this, but all are capable of it. And that, my dear friends, is your right and true way of approach to drama. If we begin straight away with the practice of dramatic art, we externalize it instead of giving it the requisite quality of intimacy and inwardness. If, however, we take our start from some narrative that makes considerable demand upon the imagination, until we really cannot help transposing ourselves into the person of whom the narrative tells, (for he is, of course, not there at all, we are obliged to, in quotes, act him), then we shall be taking the right and natural road to drama. For to produce a well-presented drama, it will hardly do for the actors to be content to study simply the speaking of their own parts. The distribution of parts in such a way that each actor receives the text only of what he himself has to speak is quite wrong. Nor can this fault be compensated for by a reading rehearsal. The one and only right way is for each actor to approach his own part in the play in the firm conviction that he must enter also into a full experience of everything his fellow actor or actors have to say. And whereas in ordinary life it is our duty to listen as quietly as possible, the actor has to speak with the other actors as much as ever he can, though not, of course, outwardly. He must share their experience. He must speak inwardly, as it were, in echo, what his fellow actors are speaking around him. I would like now to show you a path, for in all these matters I can do no more than indicate paths for you to follow. I would like to suggest a path that a young student of the drama could take in order to speak dialogue or trialogue in such a way as to give it the right intimacy and inwardness. I choose for the purpose an eminently trochaic poem that contains also a powerful dramatic element, calls it up as the poem proceeds, Der Cid by Herder. The poem begins in true epic style. Then it leads over with no uncertainty into the dramatic, and the poem is marvelously built up right through on the trochaic meter. I am here merely putting into words for you what a student would have to say to himself in preparation for working with this poem. Let us be quite clear about the situation. The ancient house of Don Diego has suffered the disgrace of being brought to ruin by an enemy house. Don Diego's son Rodrigo, who was afterward called the Cid, feels the disgrace deeply. The poem begins by picturing for us the mood of the old Don Diego in face of the ignominy that has befallen his house. Readers aside, again, there's a reading in German, then a reading in English. I'm not going to read those. And Steiner then again. And now Don Diego has his sons bound with cords, and they suffer themselves to be bound, all but the youngest, Don Rodrigo, who came to be known later on as the Cid. He alone resists. The father, although it is he himself who has bound them, is sad and troubled that his sons submit. It rejoices his heart that the youngest will not endure it. We will pass over the verses that tell how Rodrigo resolves upon the deed that he believes it his duty to perform, and go at once to the moment in the poem where we have the transition from epic to drama. Readers aside again, there's German verse, English verse. It says it is a translation by V.E.W. I'm not sure who that is. End of readers aside, and Steiner again. There you have drama coming to birth within the epic. I wanted to read you this passage from Herder's Cid because it can afford a good example of how speech training has to proceed from the speech organism itself. Everything that I say has a directly practical application, and is intended to be so taken. When by continual repetition of an exercise of this kind, we gradually approach nearer and nearer to an articulation that comes naturally, without conscious effort, when we have in this way educated ourselves for drama, starting, that is to say, from epic, then it will be good to take some passage that is on the verge of the dramatic, or rather has already passed over into it, and yet has about it still a touch of the epic, although this epic touch has virtually disappeared in the dramatic, in the same way as gesture has disappeared in the word. We shall find particularly useful in this connection one of the scenes that Lessing wrote for his projected Faust. He composed, as you know, only a very few scenes, although he left also a plan for the whole work. In the scene I refer to, we are really very little removed from the epic. Seven spirits appear, and the human character in the scene has to call upon his imagination in order to apprehend these spirits, just as in epic, the writer or speaker has to create in imagination the being whom he presents. For in a dialogue with spirits, the being of the spirit, which can only be there at all in the degree to which the human being is able to form a right conception of it, must be still more powerfully present to that human being than would be necessary if he were having a dialogue with another human being. if we succeed in placing ourselves fully into the mood that can arise in the soul when we stand over against a spirit, and are at the same time under necessity to express the experience in dramatic form, then that will mean we have found the transition from epic to drama. I want here merely to point out the path that leads from epic to drama, not to give you a recitation that I leave to Frau Dr. Steiner. So we will omit the dialogue with the first five spirits, and for the moment only give our attention to the sixth and seventh. Readers aside, again, there is now some quotes from Faust, and now we are back to Dr. Steiner again. You see how marvelously Lessing has succeeded here in bringing into the language used by Faust an absolutely living perception of these spirits, a vivid, imaginative picture of them. This will come home to you as you form his words. You will never learn to form your speaking by having it said to you. Form this sound in this way, that syllable in that way, this sentence again in such and such a way. The true forming of speech is acquired by practicing the transition from epic through the drama of the spirit to the drama of the actual and material. As we continue to practice these transitions, the genius of speech himself will receive us as his pupils, inasmuch as we shall then be walking in his paths, and upon that everything depends. It is, you know, rather remarkable that we should turn to Lessing to find our example. For the plays that Lessing brought to completion and that have become so famous are none of them on the same level. In the few scenes he wrote for a Faust, however, he transcends himself. With the possible exception of the scenes where Major Telheim figures, there's nothing in all his dramas to equal it. You can see here how Lessing is guided in the forming of his scene by the theme itself, by the material he has at hand. And that will help, too, convince you that it must be with poetry, as it was, for example, with a sculptor like Michelangelo, who used to go himself into the quarries to look for the marble for his statues. He would walk round, looking at one piece after another, until he found the only right one for an intended sculpture. Thus he let nature, through her forms, set him his task in the forms of art. We must, if we would be artists in any sphere, develop a feeling for our material. That Lessing understood this is evident in the scene we are considering. This means also that the actor or reciter needs to acquire a keen perception for the extent to which the material of the particular play or poem has found its corresponding artistic expression. Lessing was remarkably successful with his material in this instance. It was a theme that lay very near his heart, and one can only regret deeply that he did not go on with his Faust. Since, however, in this fragment he surpasses the Lessing we know elsewhere, it would have been too difficult for him to bring the work to completion. Only at certain moments was he able to develop the artistic power that he manifests here, and that is brought home to us very forcibly in the little scene that Lessing composed out of his own experience. It has been said of Lessing, and not without justification, that he was a man who never dreamed, that he was too dry and prosaic ever to have dreams. It is quite true, and his poetry bears it out. I am not referring now to Lessing's prose works, but to his poems. For all that, I am ready to assert, and please do not take what I say in the sense of a poetic picture, but as a statement of fact, I am ready to assert that this other little scene that Lessing composed for his Faust has its origin in an experience that was, in no small measure, a genuine, in quotes, waking vision. Waking vision definitely played a part in Lessing's own individual conditions of life, and a great deal that we find in his work is to be traced to this source. When Faust has let pass over him, as it were in reminiscence, all the events and experiences of the past that he has been compelled to recall in this way. Then his strong urge to reach the spiritual world brings him at last to the point of approaching it. Having completed this deep and intense study of the spiritual history of mankind, he eventually experiences in very truth that, in quotes, waking suggestion, which Lessing himself knew, and to which he here gives artistic form. The situation is as follows. A spirit with a long beard rises up out of the ground, wrapped in a mantle. Readers aside, there's now a long quote. And now we're back to Steiner again. This is as far as Lessing carried the scene. But it will, I think, be obvious at once that Lessing did not make this scene. He saw it. What we have here is a representation in art of the living human spirit. And anyone who takes the trouble to work with this passage and render it in well-formed speech will find for himself the path that leads to dramatic dialogue. It is, of course, perfectly right that the student of speech should have a correct and thorough knowledge of the various speech organs of which he makes use. But when it comes to educating oneself for a true forming of speech, then these several organs should be left alone, and the speech organism as such, the objective, extra-human speech organism, be given full play. To this end, it will certainly be essential that we regain some measure of perception for what is genuinely artistic in poetry. Such a perception will, however, in our day, have to spring from the depths of the heart, since the powers of discrimination and judgment that man had in earlier times are no longer there in the same degree today, nor can we expect to find them so for some time to come. You should really try to picture to yourselves what it meant in past epochs of culture, when Mass was celebrated, not in the language of the country, but in the Latin language, when, for example, one heard resound the words, readers aside, there's a Latin quotation by Steiner, end of aside, Steiner again, to listen to the sounding forth of these words gave man a true feeling for the forming of speech. They could not be spoken save with rightly formed speech. In the ancient mysteries there was understanding for these things. Those who took part in the ancient mysteries were conscious that when they spoke, they were holding intercourse with the gods. Man must evoke once again from the depths of his heart the power to perceive such realities. He must be able once again not merely to think within, but to speak within. Take such a scene as that read to you by Frau Dr. Steiner in the course of the second lecture, the seventh scene of my first mystery play. This scene, I can truly say, was not formed out of thoughts. Never once was there any question as to the choice of a word. The scene was heard as it is, simply heard. There were no thoughts at all. There were only words. It was a case of writing down on paper the words that were heard in the spirit. The scene was experienced from the first as formed word, not as thought. I can say the same of many of the scenes in this mystery play. And we must find a way to develop again a feeling for such things. We must learn to have a sensitive perception for what is spiritually alive in the word. Then, and only then, shall we be able again to discern for ourselves where poetry is genuinely artistic. And the reciter as well as the actor should be able to do this. He should be able to say to himself, "This is poetry, that is not." We must, of course, realize that such things cannot all at once, so soon as we have knowledge of them, be put into practice in our work on the stage. For besides actors, there are managing directors, and among them some whose connection with the stage has certainly not brought them any knowledge of this kind. No understanding to be found there of what is poetry and what is not. The only way for things to improve in this respect is for popular taste to improve. when we begin to see signs that the general public are developing discrimination, then we can hope for better days. As things are now, people have no taste, no judgment as to what is or is not artistic. Owing to this lack of taste, discussions about how this or that character was to be played began in the 90s to take quite a comic turn. It was, for instance, at one time debated, and debated even as a question of first importance, whether one should play Ferdinand in Schiller's titled Kabbalah und Liebe with hands in one's pockets, or whether, on the other hand, one should play him as a ladies' man, in quotes. Discussions of this nature actually did take place and contributed very much to the deterioration of dramatic art. The, in quotes, intellectuals then came forward and undertook to reform the art of the stage. It is, of course, a very good asset in life to be able to think, but if the utmost one can do is to think like Otto Brahm, who took, as you probably know, a notable part in the projected reforms, then it is emphatically not one's vocation to decide upon questions of dramatic art. In face of such developments, we are driven to perceive with all the more certainty that for dramatic art, intellectualism is the very last thing needed, and sensitive artistic perception the first. Volter was a really great actress. Those of you who are younger will not have seen her on the stage. Judged from university standards, Volter was the most unintelligent person there could possibly be. It is but due to her to say this, for it redounds to her fame. It does not disparage her in the very least. She did actually at long last show some sparks of intellect after Graf Sullivan had put himself to great trouble with her. But by nature she was absolutely without intellect, and yet there is no denying it. In her time and generation, she was an outstandingly great actress in certain directions, especially when she was able to keep her coquetries off the stage. I refer to things of this sort in order to make plain to you the mood and attitude of mind from which we must start if we would learn once more how to cultivate the arts of recitation and drama. The end of Lecture 4.